Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Dr. Kiki Science Hour with me, Dr. Kiki Sanford, episode 117, recorded on Thursday, October 20th, 2011. Q&A with Dr. Kiki. This episode of Dr. Kiki Science Hour is brought to you by Ford, featuring Wi-Fi connectivity with the available Sync and My Ford Touch. Now your car can be a Wi-Fi hotspot. Check it out in the new 2012 Ford Focus at Ford.com/technology. And by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All streamed directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit. To Dr. Kiki Science Hour. I am Dr. Kiki Sanford, and this is episode 117. We are going to dig into science today. I hope you're ready. It's going to be a broad spectrum because our expert today, the guest, in effect, is not answering questions, but asking them. It's you, the chat room. Unfortunately, this week I had a cancellation. And the last time we did a question and answer show, I had a really good time. And it just seemed like the perfect opportunity to try chatting with the chat room once again. So get ready with your questions, everyone, because this show, like once again, is all about you and your questions. And we will talk about science. And I look forward to that. But you know what comes first? A few science headlines, right? Let's get ready. Let's get right into it. A finding from the same laboratory that brought an announcement of faster-than-light neutrinos this time contradicts the faster-than-light phenomenon. A paper published in archive.org suggests that the neutrinos can't be traveling superluminally since they do not exhibit a specific energy spectrum indicative of faster-than-light velocity called the Cherenkov radiation. It's an effect kind of like breaking the sound barrier, but with light. Additionally, a theorist calculated that the time that the neutrinos are faster than light almost exactly corresponds to relative movement between the GPS satellites and the laboratory in Grand Sasso. So the physicists might not have found faster than light neutrinos, but rather reconfirmed Einstein's theory of relativity. The papers are coming in hard and fast to the archive.org database, and the experiments are still yet to be done, so we will see where this faster-than-light leads. The World Health Organization reported at the Gates Foundation Conference on Malaria that deaths from the disease declined over the past decade by approximately 20%. Extrapolating from that data, they predicted that malaria will be eradicated in one-third of the countries where it is a problem within the next 10 years if efforts are continued at the same rate. Along those lines, an experimental vaccine for malaria was reported to successfully protect nearly half of the babies immunized from becoming infected with malaria. Most vaccines aren't considered for use in the general population until they provide 90% protection, but this is the first vaccine against a parasite to be even slightly effective. Two studies investigating colon cancer published in Genome Research this week find a bacterium called Fusobacterium enjoying the tumor environment. The bacteria were found near, on, and digging into tumor cells taken from colon cancer patients in Canada, the U.S., Vietnam, and Spain. While not yet being confirmed as a cause of the cancers, the researchers suggested the possibility of an eventual colon cancer vaccine similar to the HPV vaccine currently in use. A study published in the journal Nature finds that longevity can be affected by epigenetics, at least in worms. The experiment altered an enzyme called SE2, which adds methyl groups to DNA, allowing the DNA to be copied and expressed. Removal of the SE2 genes extended worms' lives. When those worms were mated to normal worms, the offspring had normal SE2 expression, but experienced longer lives. The effect returned to normal after the third generation. The question now is whether a similar effect can be found in longer-lived organisms like people. Is what you do during this life going to affect your great-great-grandchildren? Could be. The Large Hadron Collider is getting ready to mix up some elements. Instead of colliding protons against protons or lead ion against lead ion, it will be proton against lead ion. Two will enter. Massive numbers of smaller particles will leave. A team from Japan won this year's Australian solar car race across 3,000 kilometers from Darwin to Adelaide. A team from the Netherlands came in second, and a team from the U.S. third. Virgin Galactic opened Spaceport America this week in the high desert of New Mexico. The 120,000-square-foot facility is the first purpose-built space liner terminal in the world. I don't know about you, but I'm going to see if I can get a visit to that spaceport. It looks like a lot of fun. And this seems like a perfect opportunity to tell you that this episode of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is brought to you by Ford. One of the latest technologies from Ford Sync with My Ford Touch is Wi-Fi connectivity. This feature can turn your car into a Wi-Fi hotspot, giving you and your passengers internet access for up to 5 devices at once. Pretty exciting. Here's how it works. Establish an internet connection to the Wi-Fi hotspot by plugging in a portable wireless access card from one of the wireless carriers into a USB port located in the center armrest console or the glove compartment or under the radio, depending on the model. Or if you have a BlackBerry, you can connect to the hotspot wirelessly via Bluetooth. Next, connect up to 5 Wi-Fi enabled devices to the hotspot using a secure password. And you're in. It's just that easy. Now you or your passengers can access music, browse the internet, download apps, or play games via Wi-Fi. Hopefully you're not doing that while you're driving, but your passengers are enjoying the experience. They can connect their laptops, tablet, mobile phones, or other internet devices to the hotspot, up to 5 devices at once, like I said, all without an additional subscription or expense. Ford Sync with My Ford Touch featuring Wi-Fi connectivity is available in the 2012 Ford Focus. You can learn more about this and other technologies Ford is bringing to its vehicles at Ford.com/technology. Okay, everybody, the time is now to bring in our special guest, which is you, as I said, the chat room. Let's start with some questions. Excuse me. I'm choking here, but I'd love to have your science-y questions, and let's talk about what you think is interesting about science, right? Let's get to it. A question from Ken Crowley 20. Do I like the science in the 6 Star Wars films? And if so, which parts of science do they get right and which parts do they get wrong in the films? That's a pretty big question. I haven't analyzed all of the science or lack of it in the Star Wars films, but that's something that I should probably get into. I do know that one of the things that they got wrong was the physics of flying in space. There were movements and sounds that were heard in the Star Wars movies with the fighters and stuff that's not very that's not accurate, seeing as space is an almost vacuum. So anyway, that stuff was wrong. Also, Chimera saying is everything in Star Wars is wrong. I don't know that everything is wrong. The lightsaber, if you could, Michio Kaku has a great segment on one of his TV series about being able to create a lightsaber and whether or not it would be possible. And I believe they came down to the idea that yes, it's possible, but that it would be very, very difficult to do. So using modern technology, it's not really something that would be possible. Anyway, I don't think everything is wrong, but we'll have to look into that. I haven't done that. Chimera, show me your link. Where does it say everything is wrong? I want to know. Mr. Library 03 is asking, is light speed still a reliable constant? Yes. The answer is yes. Light speed is still a reliable constant. Nothing has changed. The speed of light has not changed. A lot of stuff that relativity has not changed. As far as we know, everything that we base on the speed of light as our absolute speed limit for our universe, to this point in time, nothing has changed. Okay, so, and if neutrinos are found to be able to travel faster than light, which we haven't found for sure yet, we don't know whether or not that's going to change anything relative to the speed of light, because neutrinos might have some other physics that they are responding to. And this could be a very situational faster than the speed of light. Okay. Oh, Gilda is asking about the quantum levitation video that was shown. And I don't know. Tony, are you engineering right now, or is it Lynn? I don't know. Is it possible to actually show the quantum levitation video, which was pretty interesting? We don't necessarily have to show the whole thing, but we can put it up if possible. And then see if that can work. See if we can talk about it. This video has made the rounds of the internet. So I'd be surprised if many of you have not seen it. But what happens in this quantum levitation is the result of an effect called the Meissner effect. And it has to do with the interaction of superconductors and magnets. So when you bring a superconductor into a magnetic field, what occurs is the magnetic field doesn't interact with the superconductor. The superconductor, it gets its own electrical currents that start going, and the electrical currents actually shunt the magnetic field around the superconductor so that the magnetic fields don't really go into the superconductor. And what's happening in this video that was shown by these students and physicists from Tel Aviv University is this, it's as if the superconductor is stuck in space. And so what you see at the beginning of the video are a number of magnets on a paddle and this very, very cold superconducting material, probably copper-based, that is floating, in a sense, above the magnets. And in the video, the physicist says it's locked. It's quantum locked with the magnets. And so what goes on to happen is there's a circular magnet, and then they are able to quantum lock in space the superconductor over the magnet, but then it can spin because it's following the lines of the magnetic field. And remember, that magnetic field is basically going around the superconductor. So the Meissner effect shunts the magnetic field around the superconductor so that it can be pretty much held in space. And this is a very, very well-known effect. And what they're doing here that's new and different is this quantum levitation or the quantum locking. So they're using a superconducting material that's very thin. And in being very thin, there are what are called flux tubes, which are very small defined tubes where the magnetic field actually does go through the material very slightly, so that instead of only going around the superconductor, it's going around the superconductor and also through these very specific tubes that are quantum, that are determined at the quantum level within the superconductor. So it's a little bit more complex than just the Meissner effect. And the Meissner effect is pretty well known. And now, And the interesting question is, are we going to be able to use this for something like anti-gravity or new type of maglev trains or something? The problem so far is that we still don't have room temperature superconductors. And until we have superconductors that can function at room temperature, which theoretically we may never get. There's a paper out that's going to be published fairly soon that suggests that there might be limits to to what states superconductors can work in, what temperatures, what there might be a temperature limit to the working of superconductors. We might never get room temperature superconductors, but if we can get it down to a fairly reasonable temperature, maybe it's possible. The problem is that the superconductor has to be kept very cold. How do you do that? Well, you can use liquid nitrogen, or some other super cold gas that enables you to freeze the material, get it very cold so that it will have its superconducting properties and allow it to interact with the magnets in this particular way. But the energy that's used to do that, it's all a question of thermodynamics. You know, where does the energy come from and how do we do it? Magnets themselves take a lot of electricity if you're using electromagnets to maintain. So train, not necessarily. This is not an anti-gravity thing. It's a very specific effect that can only happen right now in specific states. But it's very cool, and it might yet have some interesting applications. There you go. Does that answer your question? Maybe, possibly. Stephen 3X is asking, what are my thoughts on the similarity between the microverse of atoms and molecules versus the macroverse of star systems and galaxies? I think it's all very, very interesting. And as a couple of, and all very related in terms of how it's set up. And maybe there are specific, the question is whether or not there are specific patterns that come about at different levels that are similar just because of the organizing principles of the universe. So how atoms and molecules and maybe even at the quantum level the subparticle level, quarks and everything, how do things fit together versus the very, very macro level? In my experience, I think that we have a lot in common. You look at the way that the universe is connected and you look at the way that the brain is connected. I think there are a lot of similarities there. I am really, really interested in the picture of the universe as we look at it with these tracts of material that seem to connect different areas that look like they might almost be axons, like the axons that you find in the brain that connect neurons to different places in the brain. There are very interesting, just interesting pattern similarities. However, humans are fabulous at picking out patterns in things. And so there could be a lot that's just based on human experience that we're finding these patterns. And there could also be, it could also have a lot just to do, like we find fractal geometry, repeating patterns of these fractals that repeat over and over and over again. Like maybe there is some just principle to the way that things are put together. Ulysses asks if I believe that matter evolves. And that's a great question following up from an interview I did a couple of weeks ago with Lee Cronin, who was just a really interesting chemist from the University of Glasgow. And he came up, he's got this idea that we have to reimagine evolution as not just life involving life, but all of matter. And I think he might be onto something. I don't know that I'm necessarily convinced yet. I think there needs to be more experimental evidence to go along with his idea. But I mean, so far, what we've really shown is that what we know as life evolves. So can we apply those principles and actually see and actually just include all of matter in evolutionary theory? Is it something that can be added to it? And I think it's possible. I think he's got some good arguments. And if anyone's wondering about that, I definitely suggest going back to that interview, because Dr. Cronin came up with some really interesting conceptual ideas that I just went through my mouth hanging open going, this is such, I just left that interview so excited. I thought it was really fun. Very fun. Have I tried to get Neil deGrasse Tyson on as a guest? I have not in recent times. So I tried a while ago, but I will see about getting him on. Thank you. I will see about getting him on the show. It sounds like a great idea. Let's see. EK Knapp in AK, is it Arkansas or Alaska? Alaska? Not remembering the contractions. Anyway, I have an artificial intelligence question. The experience of Deep Blue, the chess-playing computer, and Watson, the Jeopardy-playing computer, seem to show that creating artificial intelligence is crazy difficult. Could it be that we really don't understand what intelligence is yet? And I think that has a lot to do with it. EK Knapp, E-Knapp in AK, Alaska. E-Knapp in Alaska. Thank you. The intelligence is one question. What do we define as intelligence? Do we define insect behavior as intelligence, the animal intelligence? Of course, there's some amount of planning that's going into their behavior, but there's just so much just natural responses to instinctual responses to chemical signals that they do without even thinking about them. Is that a level of intelligence? At what level do you say that a bird is intelligent versus a dog versus a human? There are all these different types of intelligence that we have to think about. So it's not only what is intelligence and how much of intelligence do we understand, but it's what kind of intelligence are we trying to program into the computers? Are we trying to program Watson or Deep Blue to be insightful like human beings, or are we simply trying to get them to be intelligent enough to beat you at chess? Are we trying to get them to have, as Stephen three times says here, intelligence versus sentience, right? So it's intelligence versus intelligence with consciousness. Are we trying to imbue some aspects of consciousness into these artificially intelligent creations? And as far as these programs go, these computers that we've given intelligence, sure, Watson is able to look up very quickly answers to questions because it's been programmed with a certain amount of natural language understanding. So it's able to parse the language to be able to infer the meaning of the question and from there look up an answer. Intelligence might be given to even some search engines that we have online. And I think that would even, I mean, I think at this point, the intelligence of Watson was about at the level of a really good search engine with natural language ability. The question about intelligence and making artificial intelligence, as I've said, it just comes down to what are you trying to create? The answer, do we not understand intelligence? And if you're asking human intelligence and consciousness, absolutely not. We do not understand those yet. And there's a long way to go. And some people think that we are never actually going to be able to create something as complex as the human brain, to be able to actually mimic something as intelligent as the human brain. Dr. T is saying a program is the opposite of intelligence. Okay, so if you have a program, sure, a software program is a special set of instructions that instructs the hardware, so software and hardware, what to do. So we have programs in ourselves, but there's something else on top of our programs that allows us to, on top of our programming that allows us to have unique human experiences and to have the unique psychological experiences that we have. So the from there, the question is, you know, what is it, where does it become programming, and what's the line between programming and consciousness? I think that's a very, very interesting question and a very interesting line. At a certain reductionist level, where you want to just break things down to their very finest points, there's an argument that people might not be really anything more than programming, but that's a lot of programs working together in parallel through our neuronal network that allows us to do things in such a complex way that it seems as though we don't have programming, or it seems as though it's spontaneous. Anyway, let's think about that for a while. What else was the question here? There was a question. A tourist asked what motivated me to specialize in neurophysiology, an interest in behavior. So how or why do different organisms do different things? And it started with an interest in birds, really. I got interested in just studying birds in their natural habitat and finding out what they were doing there. And the question got to why they were doing what they were doing there. And everything leads back to the brain. The brain is the control box for everything that you do. So is it a matter of, at that point, it just became a matter of, okay, well, I need to study the brain of the birds to figure out why they're doing what they're doing. And in the whole process, that got me interested, of course, in the human brain. And I'm just very interested in how nerves, neurons send their messages, how the brain works, the brain generally, and then differences between different species. So why is one species one way while another is a different way? How are we similar to other species in the way that our brains work? Even though our brain is a different structure than the bird brain, how is it set up to do very similar behaviors? Yeah, a lot of interesting stuff there. Very interesting stuff. Miranda Janelle is asking, at this point in human history, do I think another episode of the Dark Ages would be likely to occur? At this point in time, I think the only thing that would lead to a Dark Ages occurring would be a natural catastrophe affecting our ability to communicate and to have access to information. So something extremely massive, like a solar flare, maybe a massive solar flare coming from the sun that wipes out satellites, that maybe because of our electrical grid being overloaded, wipes out the electrical grid. And so we don't have electricity, that cuts down on the internet. I mean, at something like that, though, isn't even going to destroy everything, because even though we won't have phones or electricity or internet, we probably would still have, we could have radio, hand crank radio type stuff. We have gasoline still, as long as that's working. So people can still get places and still communicate. And then we still have books. And so we still have all sorts of information. And we have the postal service, maybe with horses, I don't know, sending letters. So I don't, at this point in time, it would take something like the perfect global storm to shunt us all the way back to a Dark Ages, where we are unconnected, unable to communicate ideas, and unable to take advantage of the work of past philosophers, scientists, engineers, it's big thinkers. So I think it would have to be something absolutely spectacular that would put us back to the Dark Ages, so to speak. I mean, who knows? Maybe we're working up to it right now, but I wouldn't jump into that kind of worrying very easily. I don't think you need to worry too much. Other questions. Rock Law is interested in having me get Bob McDonald of CBC's Quirks and Quarks on the show, talk about how to report science in mainstream media. I think that's a, and he's not a scientist, but he hosts the second most awesome science show after mine, of course. He's West Coast now. And that's fantastic. Yeah, that's a great idea. I like having, I really enjoy having other science journalists on the program from time to time to bring in another voice about science and, you know, science journalists are experts in science because that's what their beat is. That's what they put themselves, they spend their time doing. So science writers and science reporters, while not maybe specializing in one particular scientific field, they specialize in communicating science. And so to talk with them about something scientific is often very enlightening and very interesting. And they're often very interesting people to talk to as well. I'm going to scroll down the chat room a little bit. Aaron B is asking me about the Bloop. Which I haven't read into this really, but it's an ultra low frequency, extremely powerful underwater sound detected by NOAA, National Organization for Atmospheric. What is it? National Organization for Atmospheric. I'm blanking on the last A, right? National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association. There we go. I'm remembering it. Okay, in 1997, called the Bloop. Have I heard of this? Do I have any insights as to what it could have been? I do not know about the Bloop. I don't know about the Bloop. Sounds interesting. I'll have to find out about it. Have to figure that out. Jess asks, if I had my genome sequenced, would I worry about somebody getting a hold of it? No, I would not worry about somebody getting a hold of my personal genome. At this point in time, I don't know what somebody would necessarily do if they had my personal genome or anyone's personal genome for that matter. Even now we're not using DNA maybe some people are, but I'm not using DNA as a security measure for anything. I'm not using DNA identification for my email or my bank information or anything of that sort. So in terms of identification purposes and people maybe doing stolen identity, not really even worried about that at this point in time because it's not an issue. I mean, my identity is not linked scientifically or officially to my DNA, nor is yours. Additionally, I drop hair follicles all the time. I'm sloughing off skin. I bite my fingernails, spit out a little piece of fingernail. There's constantly material from me that is being sloughed off, left in the environment that I can't control because I don't live in a plastic bag, that could be picked up by somebody and sequenced and used if they were going to use it. So there's really, at this point in time, I can't see any reason to be concerned about it. And I'm really not concerned about somebody stealing my genetic information so that they could, in a laboratory, create my genetic sequence and stuff it into an egg and then create Kiki clones that would take over the world of science. I don't think that's going to happen, so I'm just really not worried about it. It's outlandish enough that the likelihood is very slim, and so it's not something I'm going to worry about. Really not a worry to me, but thanks for the question. Was fun to kind of go off on a little tangent there. And speaking of going on tangents, every once in a while, I like to search around for new shows to watch and things to spend my ever diminishing free time, letting my brain simmer on other things. And I really like to go to Netflix to get some of that material. So this episode of Dr. Kiki Science Hour is brought to you by Netflix. Netflix streams thousands of TV episodes and movies directly to you instantly, which means that you save time, money, and hassle. And there are several easy ways that you can instantly access streaming movies and TV shows with Netflix. You can watch Netflix movies and TV shows on your Mac or PC or iPad, and you can watch on your iPhone, some Android phones as well. If you have a gaming console, like an Xbox 360, PS3, or a Nintendo Wii, you can watch Netflix right on your television. And you can do that as well if you have an Apple TV or a Roku box and aren't a gamer. With Netflix, you can watch movies and TV shows instantly using any of these devices. And the neat part is that you can start watching a movie or a show on one device and then finish on a completely different one. So you're not tied to like being in your living room watching your media center computer or whatever it happens to be. Whichever way you choose to access Netflix, you can watch as many, many movies and TV shows as you want anytime you want, and you can cancel at any time. Try Netflix today for 30 days for free. Go to netflix.com/twit. Be sure to use this URL when you sign up for your free trial. It's netflix.com/twit. We thank Netflix for their support of Twit and Dr. Kiki Science Hour, and we hope that you enjoy watching instantly with Netflix. Back to the questions. This is the instant answer episode of Dr. Kiki Science Hour. I'm scrolling way down the chat room. I apologize if I missed your question. Web234 says that I'm probably more nurture than nature, so a clone is useless. And that's a really good point as well. So even going back to the question of whether or not I'd be worried about somebody having my genetic sequence, if somebody did have it and did try to create a clone, that clone would not be me because they would not have the lifetime of experiences that I have had to make me who I am. Nature is as important as nurture. Nurture, nurture, nurture. Nurture the babies, and each one will be different, its own unique individual. I hope the chat room. See, before the show, I as suggested that I was going to get a whole bunch of marriage proposals during the show. But honestly, I think it's just going to be people talking about cloning me, right? No. Craziness. Craziness is becoming this science show. Let's see. Have I seen the Make article on how to make LED hula hoops? I haven't, but that's a really, I should go look for it. I have an LED hula hoop, but I did not make it. I got it from somebody else. It's a lot of fun. Did I know that the Canadian biotech science drama Regenesis is available on Netflix? No, I didn't, and I haven't tried watching that yet. So that could be fun. I'm always looking for new things to watch. Scrolling down the chat room, why do some fruits begin to rot from the inside out, whereas others don't? Is there a scientific explanation for this? There is, and I don't remember all the details on it, but I do think that it has to do with compounds that are released from the seeds of the fruit. I'm not going to get this right because I haven't looked this up. It's not something that I can talk about just off the top of my head. I do know, however, that there are volatile compounds that are released from fruits and vegetables, like bananas tend to release a bunch of this volatile compound, and it affects the ripening of the fruits around them. So I think that was one way to ripen your tomatoes, put them in a paper bag, keeps the compound, which I'm not remembering the name of, closer. Ethylene gas. Say thank you, Sea Cliff Troll. It's ethylene gas that is released, and that ethylene gas will affect the ripening of those tomatoes. But in terms of what's released from the inside of the fruit, I do not know. But I'm sure there is a scientific explanation for it. And I don't know whether some versus others would be a reason. It may have done something to do with sugars and, I don't know, maybe bacteria that get involved. No idea. It's a really interesting question. Thanks for asking that. And if anybody has an answer to it, if anybody has an idea, let me know. Let me know what you think. Scrolling up, is there a scientific reason that cats are so cute? It has to do with their furriness, their large eyes, and the fact that they look at you and go, meow, and then they play hard to get, right? But I would say that the scientific reason that people perceive cats as cute, and not all people do perceive cats as cute, by the way, is that they play on certain psychological traits of humans based on our social nature. So cats use our social behaviors, I guess, against us in a certain sense, to play on us, to allow us to think of them as cute. It's an interesting concept, but I honestly believe we are being manipulated by the cats. I love them all the same. And yes, I do think they're cute because I get to pet them and it's very nice. But my co-host Justin on This Week in Science would argue against me on this one about the cat cuteness. But he would probably agree with the comment that cats are manipulators. I would think that. Other questions about science and other things you guys want to talk about scientifically? What are things that I missed from earlier in the show that people put in the chat room that were stated? Ulysses asked a question. Does music play an important part of brain development? You could ask Mark Changizi that question. He's written a book called Harnessed, and it has to do with language development and music and how we've harnessed powers of our brain to allow us to do particular behaviors. So music in itself is not necessarily important to brain development. However, it is important for us to hear. And in our hearing environment, we are exposed to sounds of all types, whether they be voices or environmental sounds. And it's not going to hinder our mental or brain development to not be exposed to music. However, the idea is that by being exposed to something that is more than just voices or environmental sounds, that it's a created package of sounds, whatever music happens to be, that can stimulate our brain in a unique way, and maybe lead to cognitive development or more rapid cognitive development. However, it hasn't necessarily been actually confirmed. So the question, the scientific studies that have been done so far, they suggest that musicians or kids who study music have higher IQs, or, you know, there are all sorts of studies about stuff like this, right? That Web5773 is saying that music is intellectually stimulating, right? The question is, why is it intellectually stimulating, and does it actually change brain development? Sure. So if it's stimulating, it's going to affect brain development in one way or another. But individuals who don't get music, it's not going to make them dumb. It's not going to make you dumber if you don't have music in your life. Ulysses says different paths in the brain, Dr. Kiki. So it's a really interesting question. Ulysses is also saying it can help build links in your neurons. Yeah, but so can swimming or playing baseball or having a conversation. There are all sorts of things that can strengthen connections within your brain. It's just a matter of which connections are being strengthened. There is a certain certain there's some idea that music, because it is such a complex endeavor, and listening to music doesn't it isn't just listening to music. It also stimulates areas of the brain that that have to do with higher thought, and so you're making different connections within your brain than cracking branch, something in the environment that I might need to look out for, you know, something of that sort. Let's see. Another question back to cats is whether or not cats have. And this has to do with all animals, really. Have they learned to it's better to communicate through meowing with humans? And so it's true. Cats, there's this idea that cats meow to other to meow to humans, but they don't meow to other cats, which is not true. Cats do meow to each other, but they meow more and in specific ways to humans that they know gets them particular results. There are studies that show that cats have learned that people respond to give them something like food or a treat if they meow with a particular kind of meow that has kind of a trill to it. So kind of sound makes people more likely to give them something that they want than just a meow. So they have attention getting meows. They have the meows that want to get something more from you than just attention. And there's some crazy number of different sounds that cats use in communicating with humans. And I don't remember the exact number, but it's actually, there's a very diverse language that cats have developed to communicate with us. And we have adapted to understand. So there's this cross communication. We understand it and we can communicate with our animals. It's very interesting. And cats also have body language to communicate with each other. Exactly, Goldizater. And we don't necessarily understand that body language. So cats communicate the same way that we do with body language. And cats don't necessarily understand our body language either. So they're in terms of vocal communication, we're doing really well. But in terms of body language understanding, I think that humans and cats have a lot more that we need to learn from each other. Us and dogs, however, we are doing a pretty good job in terms of understanding dog body language, and especially with programs like the Dog Whisperer and stuff, that is getting communicated more broadly. You know, don't approach a dog when their tail isn't wagging, you know, that kind of stuff. Let's see. Why do we need to dream in our sleep? I don't know that we necessarily do need to dream XYZ. That's a really, really interesting question. The fact that we do dream, it means that it occurs only during one particular phase of sleep. And usually it has to do with patterns of neurons getting re-stimulated. So there's an idea that it might have to do with memory consolidation, so that as your brain kind of runs through things that happened to it during the day, or kind of replaying what occurred, and maybe even bringing in things that you've been thinking about a lot, that affects the dreams that you actually have. So you know, we don't necessarily scientifically understand dreams at this point in time. And most people do dream at some point in time, although you do not dream every time you sleep. Gilda asks, as the universe continues to expand and cool, in the distant future, would the value of absolute zero change from what it is today? And or as the energy cools, would we expect new forms of matter? There might be new forms of matter. However, we probably would not be there to see it. In terms of the expansion and the cooling and absolute zero, absolute zero is zero. That's something that we have been trying to reach in a laboratory. But we can't actually reach it and measure it because here's the thing about zero. Absolute zero means that there is absolutely no movement. It has to do with, it's a thermodynamic measure, and it has to do with the movement of atoms, the vibration of matter. And at absolute zero, nothing moves. There is no motion, and so everything would be entirely locked. And one of the problems that we have in the laboratory of being able to actually measure absolute zero is you have to have something that moves and that isn't completely at absolute zero during the measurement. And so there is a disconnect there between the two. So absolute zero will always be absolute zero, and the cooling of the universe will eventually take it to a state of no movement, of everything being locked and at a temperature of absolute zero. So absolute zero will not change. And as the energy cools, would we expect new forms of matter? That's a really interesting question. It would have to do with the way things combine as they cool down. And usually we see new forms of matter as we heat things up. We might see not necessarily new forms of matter, but new ways of things interacting with each other. So as we've found with superconductors, they have to be super cooled for them to have for the materials to have their superconducting capacity. We don't have a room temperature superconductor. So most superconductors are at something like, I don't know, colder than 250 degrees. I mean, they're pretty cold materials to be able to have those traits. And Stephen Three Times says, of course, energy and matter are exactly the same thing, but at different velocities, right? And as he says here, absolute zero takes matter to its slowest possible state. Exactly. Thank you for clarifying that. Let's see, what else are the questions? If it's absolute zero and matter cannot move, wouldn't that redefine what the hardest substance is? It would change the way that the states that everything is in. So the way that we look at water on our planet, based on where it is and the temperature of our planet, we have liquid water. However, if you go further out in the solar system to some place like Jupiter or Saturn, the water is frozen. So you have water ice. And things that are gases here on our planet are liquids on Jupiter and Saturn. So imagine taking that one step further so that the liquids on Jupiter and Saturn would be frozen. And the water on that's ice in those places would be still ice. And maybe even sublimated. So there's some really interesting questions as to what occurs. But the thing that you have to understand about absolute zero is that because nothing is moving, you have matter at its slowest possible state, its lowest possible state, and all of matter at its lowest possible state, there can be no interactions, or there should be no interactions. Everything will be, everything that it kind of gets locked into, if it gets locked into a crystalline state or a structure, it will stay in that structure most likely. There's some really interesting questions as to what would happen at absolute zero. But the big point of it is that we would be long dead. Long dead. Dr. T says, when scientists use the word liquid referring to a planet, does it always refer to water? No, it does not always refer to water. So like I said, we have liquid water here, but it is frozen water. It is ice. It would be ice. Yeah, ice water on another planet. or water gas, water vapor someplace else. So that's just specifically referring to just water, but it could, liquid is a state. So you have liquid, gas, and solid, right? Solid, liquid, gas. And so the solid and plasma also, if you want to go plasma as well, but gas, liquid, solid are the states of whatever you're talking about. And you're going to be specific about whatever it is in whichever environment that you're talking about it. Let's see. Asking questions about electrons and neutrinos at zero, at absolute zero. As far as I understand, and there's nothing... there's no reactions that can occur at zero. I don't know how light is affected by absolute zero, but that's a really good question. Yeah, that's a really great question. I would imagine that light would still be able to travel. And neutrinos... Possibly would still be able to travel. But whatever created those things would have probably stopped. So the sun at absolute zero would not be able to burn. The sun would not be working. But the photons of light that it shot out previously would probably still work. Is there an equation that puts together light and temperature? Because I know I'm thinking of like absolute gas law, PVNRT, and like, you know, things where pressure, volume, and temperature are related, but not necessarily involving something like light and something that is moving. So like a photon of light, as Mr. Library 3 says, it has no mass, right? Anyway, it's very interesting. Very interesting. There must be an equation, right, Slug? There must. Let's see. But light can also be slowed down in different mediums. So if you put light in water, it gets slowed down. So if... I mean, the problem here is we're talking about the universe that's expanding. And so in expanding, it's becoming much more diffuse and dispersed. But so you would think that, because it would be much more dispersed. So there wouldn't be anything for the light to run into that would slow it down. So it wouldn't be like suddenly the universe turned into a block of ice and light could not travel through it. Quickly. Wouldn't be like that. It would be like there's just everything. The space is a vacuum aside from those points in space that where there is matter. So the matter is becoming further and further spread apart, slowing down. It's not moving as much, but photons of light are going to travel for a time. But because everything's spreading apart and slowing down and matter's not moving as much, there's less light being created. And so slowly the universe will become very dim. And eventually things will blink out of existence. This is interesting. Very interesting. Great question. Great, great question. Hey, it's 5:15. I think I started my show sometime around about this time. So I think it's been about an hour. Did you guys have any other questions you wanted to get to? Because that one kind of took me off on a tangent for a little while. Right. Replicant XR, X3R0, the very cheerful future that we have ahead of for us. It's the future of the universe, maybe. It might not even end up going that way. And it's definitely not the future of humanity because the likelihood of us actually living as a species that long, that in exactly this form, without making any changes to our consciousness or the way that we experience the universe, is probably very, very dim because that is billions, trillions of years in the future. And If you think of the very small sliver of time that we have been in existence and everything that came before us and everything that will come after us, humanity still, we still have a chance to live a very bright, cheerful existence. And I hope you will, you know, go to sleep with a smile on your face thinking about that. And does the expansion of the universe alter the distances that we use to measure the speed of light? That's a really good question, Slug. And that's one of the reasons that we are constantly updating our standard candles to make sure that our calculation of distance is accurate. So not just using supernovas, but if the expansion of the universe, the question is whether or not the expansion of the universe is homogeneous or heterogeneous. So is it happening the same everywhere, or is it expanding more rapidly in different places? And the latter seems to be the case. And if that is the case, that is what could really mess us up, because the distance or the movement of our standard candles is possibly different in different places. So if it's expanding more slowly in one place and more quickly in another, the standard candles in one area are going to get further away faster than in another area. So the heterogeneous expansion of the universe is something that needs to be worked out, although that's just a new question that physicists are working on. Rocklaw wants to see more space stuff, more geology stuff, more archaeology stuff. We will have all sorts of stuff, I'm sure. And Rorks is asking if the end of the universe is a certainty and whether or not the answer to that question depends on the effect of dark matter. And you're absolutely right. I mean, there are still, these are hypotheses. These are ideas that theoretical physicists have put out there, and they have math to support them. They have a lot of experimental evidence that supports one thing or another that is put this idea on the table in the first place. However, we don't actually really know enough yet to know how things are going to play out in the universe. What's at the center of the universe? That's a great question, Reverend DC. It might be a white hole as opposed to a black hole sucking things in. Maybe it's a white hole that spewed our universe out. How about that one? And I will scroll down to the end. I should probably just stop looking and stop trying to answer questions in the chat room. I'm not going to be able to get to everything, unfortunately. Suns are not white holes. No, that's not what I said. It's said that there is a black hole at the center of each galaxy. I'm not going to answer why at this point, Clay Ferguson. And it's postulated that there may be white holes at the center of every universe, if it's true that there are multiple universes. That's a completely different question. Good gracious. White holes collapse if there's matter nearby, so they cease to exist immediately. Well, then we won't find the white hole there, will we? And that's just a postulation as well. This is all just Golda Seder. It's all just fascinating. I love the idea of the white holes. If there was a white hole spewing a universe into existence, it wouldn't cease to exist immediately, because there would be stuff that comes out. I mean, there was a long time before things actually, whatever it was that the white hole spewed out, turned into matter. There was a very long time. It was a very long time. We haven't gone back that far. Cool. Gilda gave me a link to the LED hula hoop thing. Awesome. Hawaii Dave says white holes do not exist. It's an idea that theoretical physicists have come up with. And yes, Clay Ferguson says Big Bang was a white hole, maybe the opposite side of a black hole. And there are some really interesting articles out there. I read one in Scientific American a couple of years ago that was all about white holes. Very interesting reading. And Stephen three times says that he thinks I could do this every week and have a lot of fun. And the truth is, I do this every week over on Justin TV. Not here at Twit TV, but maybe I will make it a more regular occurrence, because you guys seem to have fun asking a bunch of questions and I like prattling on, and it gives me material to think about for possible interviews. So maybe we can get, you know, a physicist on to talk about white holes, black holes, that kind of stuff. The end of the universe. Why not? Why not? Let's, you know, it gives me some ideas. So for me, this is a really great interaction with you guys. If you want to talk with me more and ask more questions and spew out your own ideas in chat rooms, JustinTV/Dr. Kiki. And I do a science chat every Friday from noon to 1 p.m. Pacific time over there. So every Friday you can come chat with me just like this. Just like this. But I think that about does it for this week's episode of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. I'm sorry we did not have battery technology this week. I was looking forward to talking about batteries because there's some neat stuff on the horizon out there. And it seems like every time I talk to somebody who says batteries are, you know, better batteries are a long way off, there's a story that comes out that suggests that better batteries are actually closer than we think. So there you go. I still have to get somebody on to talk about batteries. But next week, we're talking about energy and the science of Boing Boing with Boing Boing's science editor, Maggie Coarth Baker. So I'm looking forward to next week's show. I hope you are as well. And I hope that you will be back here, same time, same place, 4 to 5 p.m. Pacific time on the Twit Network for more Dr. Kiki Science Hour. And until then, you can follow my sciencey pursuits online at Twitter, at Dr. Kiki, or at drkiki.tv, my website. On Google Plus, I'm Kiki Sanford, and maybe soon to be Dr. Kiki. I have to find out if I can change to a pseudonym and not lose my verified status. But anyway, that's a tangent. I also have a Facebook fan page, Dr. Kiki, and you can subscribe to Dr. Kiki Science Hour in iTunes, or you can just go find past episodes at twit.tv/Kiki. And if you need to contact me, want to send me an email, you can email me at drkiki@drkiki.tv. So many different ways to interact out there. I will see you next week. Thanks for tuning into my Science Hour. All I ask is 1 hour a week. It's not that much. Remember, 1 hour a week makes your world a whole lot more interesting. Now for your science meditation of the week. It's the Cube Solver 2, I think is what it's called. And you can find it at ArcTechCon, I think, which is going to be October 25th and 26th in San Jose area. ArcTechCon, which I think is going to do with Android. So.